Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Freddie Sayers. Welcome to Unheard. We like to look for important things that aren't yet being talked about, but are coming down the track. One of these, we think, are some legal cases currently being considered by the Supreme Court in the US on the topic of affirmative action, otherwise known as positive discrimination, on the grounds of race. What you're about to hear is a clip of lead attorney for Harvard being questioned by Chief Justice Roberts.
There is no doubt that for, as the testimony showed, that for applicants who are essentially so strong on multiple dimensions that they are sort of on the bubble, that they are a real candidate for admission, being African American or being Hispanic or in some instances being Asian American can provide one of many, many tips that will put
people say that, yes, but you will have to concede that if it provides one of many, then in some cases it will be determined.
I do concede that.
Okay, so we're talking about race as a determining factor in admission to Harvard.
Most observers seem to think that the court will actually overturn previous judgments and deem it unconstitutional to consider race at all in university admissions. This could have a huge knock-on effect on the whole concepts of equity, on how corporate boards are filled, on how scholarships and places and jobs are given. If it happens, it's going to be huge. The man behind both of the biggest cases being heard by the Supreme Court is called Edward Bloom. He's a conservative legal strategist, and he's devoted decades of his life to campaigning against racial affirmative action. It looks like his lifelong campaign might just be about to be successful. I wanted to knock about the arguments with him from all sides. People on the progressive left might think he's rolling back progress, paving the way for some kind of suppression of minorities. Meanwhile, people on the libertarian right might well think he doesn't go far enough. Either way, they're important ideas that you might just be about to hear a lot more about. I spoke to him from his home in Maine. Welcome, Mr. Bloom.
Freddie, thanks for having me.
So what is the current case that is most likely going to be considered next? Give us the background on that.
There are two cases pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. They are styled Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, and a similar case, Students for Fair Admissions versus the University of North Carolina. Students for Fair Admissions is a membership organization that I founded back in 2014. We sued Harvard and we sued the University of North Carolina, arguing that their admissions policies violate the current laws regarding race and ethnicity in college admissions. But moreover, and really more importantly, we argue before the court that allowing race and ethnicity to be a factor at all in college admissions violates the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence going back dozens and dozens of years, and it violates the U.S. Constitution.
I think we might have to back up a little bit, Mr. Bloom. I'm just thinking for our viewers over here in Europe or people who are not familiar with the current situation. Let's just describe what's happening with university admissions. So currently, universities are allowed to, and indeed do, at least elite colleges, overtly take into account the ethnicity of applicants in their final selection for the student body. So they might say, we want more people of this race, we want less people of this race, on the grounds of better representing the country, or, you know, making up for historic injustices, or whatever the arguments may be. But that's what's currently happening. Is that a fair summary?
Well, that is a fair summary. The United States law today, as interpreted about 20 years ago by the Supreme Court, allows colleges and universities to put a thumb on the scale based upon a student's race or ethnicity. In the case of Harvard and other elite universities, that thumb on the scale is now diminishing the opportunity of Asian Americans to be admitted, while boosting the likelihood that African Americans, Hispanics, and whites will be admitted. And this is a story that's not only going on at Harvard, but at competitive universities like Yale and Princeton and Stanford and dozens of other colleges.
So what does that mean? It's boosting whites, because I think most people would understand that there's an Asian American controversy in that they overperform in standardized tests, and if there was no affirmative action in each direction, they would have an overrepresented portion of the student body of elite colleges. But what you're saying is that actually, in some cases, this form of affirmative action helps whites.
It does.
How does that work?
Well, let me give you an example that we presented in court that was not impeached by our opponents. If you look at a typical Asian American male applicant to Harvard, and look at the quantitative academic skills and performance of that applicant, and assume that applicant's grades and test scores have a 25% likelihood that applicant will be admitted to Harvard. Now, change the race of that applicant, but hold everything else in place. Change that applicant's race to white, the likelihood that white student will be admitted goes up to 36%. Change the race to Hispanic, the likelihood now jumps to 75%. And change the race to African American, that student now has a 95% chance of being admitted to Harvard. This is not a light thumb on the scales. This is a dispositive policy that prohibits better qualified Asian Americans from being admitted.
So is it mainly I'm trying to work out what's animating your mission, that you've spent so many years on this. Is it mainly a sense of unfairness towards the Asian American community, or is it more of a defense of meritocracy from first principles, or are you worried about other minorities? What's driving you?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and it's a complex question because there isn't a real simple answer. I think what drives me and what drives this movement is the belief that America was born with a terrible scar on its history, and that is the history of slavery that then evolved into a history of Jim Crow racism against African Americans. What came out of that, what was bitterly fought on the battlefields and in the courthouses of America, is the belief that your race and your ethnicity should not be used to help you or to harm you in your life's endeavors, whether you're applying for a job, whether you're applying to be admitted to college or a medical school, whether your neighborhood is drawn into one voting district or a different voting district, your race shouldn't be used as an element in any of those endeavors. So that's what drives me, and that's what drives, frankly, the vast majority of Americans who, when polled about the use of race and ethnicity in college admissions or employment or other areas, believe that race shouldn't be a part of these decisions. That's what I think drives me the most.
So this is the famous Martin Luther King quote about being judged on the content of your character, not by the color of your skin. And yet, when people talk about colorblind admissions or That phrase has itself become controversial in recent years, such as the strange time we live in, that somehow that is seen as code for reversion to majority dominance or something. Do you use the phrase colorblind?
Well, I do. Just as the founders of the modern civil rights movement used colorblind, there are, you know, I think a small minority of Americans, they are of good faith, who see colorblindness as a reversion to white supremacy. However, in poll after poll, going back 30 years, Americans celebrate the idea of colorblindness. They don't want their race to be used as an element in whether they're hired or fired, or whether the police pull them over, or whether they're selected for jury duty and sit on a jury. Americans embrace colorblindness, and it's not just white Americans, it's a vast majority of Hispanics, African Americans, and Asians.
We had a conversation with Glenn Lowry last year, who was actually the first person to alert me to this impending Supreme Court decision. Let's
Court
play the clip.
Six conservative justices, the majority of whom have publicly stated that they have serious doubts about affirmative action, about the constitutionality of affirmative action. Now, I've already given my position here that I think the 14th Amendment does not forbid the use of racial preferences, but I'm not a lawyer and I'm not on the Supreme Court. There's a very good chance that racial affirmative action will be stricken by the Supreme Court. If it happens, I assure you, there will be mobs in the streets of this country. No one is going to take, no progressive activist is going to take the Supreme Court's ruling as an opportunity to turn within and to consider, if we want to be at Harvard or the University of North Carolina in larger numbers, why don't we get busy preparing our youngsters from the cradle to be competitive in this great country that we live in, where competition is the coin of the realm? No, they're not going to do that. They're going to interpret that as an anti-Black move by a racist Supreme Court. I assure you that it is a disaster, and I think we're headed to.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What's your reaction to what Glenn had to say?
I admire Glenn Lowry immensely. Although I think his concern about riots in the streets and protests, I think that's probably incorrect. And let me tell you why. I think now it's 9 states throughout the U.S., voters have already expressed their opinion on this. in the state of California in 1996, by a significant majority, Californians voted to end affirmative action. That was in 1996. In 2020, that question was put before the voters once again. And this is in California, probably the most liberal state in the union. Once again, the liberal voters in the state of California voted to ban affirmative action in state policies. This tells us something. If California, we're not talking about Oklahoma here, Freddie, or Texas. This is California. They gave Joe Biden a 30-point margin in the election. At the same time, Californians were voting for Joe Biden. They voted no for the reintroduction of affirmative action. The state of Washington as well. So I admire Professor Lowry, but I think I don't think that's how it's going to play out at the Supreme Court.
So how will it play out then? I mean, let's start with the practical effects, because you gave us some percentages there which were estimates of how different ethnic groups would perform. I mean, I've got the current Harvard diversity statistics here by ethnicity. They say that in their current most recently admitted class, African American is 15.2%, Asian American 27.9%, Hispanic or Latino 12.6%, Native American 2.9%, Native Hawaiian 0.8%, and no other ethnicity is mentioned, which I guess means that roughly 50% would be white. How would that change in your estimate if this is stricken down?
Well, we did a study for the courts back in 2018, and the premise was if Harvard only uses grade point averages and standardized test scores as a metric for admissions, it's likely that Asian Americans will make up about 50% of the incoming freshman class. Hispanics will go up slightly. Whites and African Americans will go down slightly.
Do you have estimates for how far down they would go? I mean, it's kind of important, isn't it?
Yes. African Americans would drop to about 10% of the incoming freshman class from now about 15%.
Which would leave whites roughly...
I think whites came in at around 30%, if I'm not mistaken. Hispanics also, I think, about 10%, maybe a little bit more than that. But no one is advocating, nor do we think that Harvard or any competitive university is just going to say, well, we can't use race, so we're just going to use grade point averages and standardized test scores. That's not what's going to happen. Harvard, I believe, will be compelled to change the entire framework of their admissions policies. Right now, there is a significant boost given to students whose parents attended Harvard, the legacy status. That may be changed dramatically by Harvard. The tips given to certain athletes, those who play water polo or fencing, that may be changed. And more importantly than even those two, Harvard may start to lower the bar a little bit for kids who have come from very modest or even disadvantaged backgrounds, who are the first in their family to attend college, who are raised by a single parent whose family income falls below a certain level.
But wait, so you would approve of that? If
we absolutely would. And we advocated for this in court, and we've advocated for this at the Supreme Court. This was an important element of our argument.
So you're not against affirmative action then. You're only against affirmative action on racial grounds. If it's affirmative action on other aspects of your background, your social economic group or education, you're all for it.
That's perfectly said. This organization is against race-based affirmative action, having race as an element. However, we encourage Harvard and other universities to use socioeconomic affirmative action. change your internal policies that make it easier to attract a truly diverse group of individuals, not just diverse by skin color and hair texture, but people who have come, young people who have come from very different backgrounds than what Harvard has today.
I guess my gut feeling would be that a lot of people who are conservative might feel this is an ancient college with its own history, its own religious traditions, it's a private institution, although it receives funding from the state, rather like a club or any kind of private organization. They should have the right to arrange the people who come around the sort of ethos of the college in some way. I think there's a libertarian objection to what you're saying, which is that in effect it's the state not allowing you to make your own decisions as a private institution. What would you say to those people?
Well, we have a solution to those objections, and that is Harvard can forgo receiving federal funds. There are a handful of colleges and universities in the United States that have done exactly that. They do not accept federal funds. Hillsdale College is probably the best known. If Harvard chooses to not accept federal funds, then they can shape the class any way they would like. And further to that point, talking about, what would the conservative kind of cohort think if indeed various colleges and universities had 50% Asian? Well, we saw that outcome, or close to that outcome, in the state of California. Asian admissions rates at the two most competitive schools in the University of California system, Berkeley and UCLA Los Angeles, saw their Asian population skyrocket in 1997 and 1998. Yet, here it is in 2020, the population there could have said that there's just too many Asians, but they chose not to do that. So I don't think the conservative or even liberal factions in this country would object if, based upon a meritocratic, fair system, that the outcome shows that Asian Americans make up a significant majority at any college or university.
I guess the opposite critique, the argument from the progressive wing, would be that if you remove the right to actually work to quotas, these private institutions will find other ways around to prefer and to prioritize the groups they like. For example, earlier in the century, back in the 20s and 30s, the controversy was about Jews and Jewish students. And there were growing proportions of Jewish students at some of these colleges. And a lot of the old white people in charge didn't like it much. And they found ways, I don't think they were overt, but they would just say, I recognize that surname. And I think we won't take that person. I think the argument from the left might be, it would be nice to live in a world where we could just admit on basis of meritocracy. But unless you shoehorn it, unless you force these institutions to take people in certain percentages, we're going to find ourselves inching back to a world where they just prioritize their preferred groups. Why are they wrong?
Well, they're wrong because I think for two reasons. Number one, it assumes that the academic gaps between African Americans and Hispanics and whites and Asians are intractable, that there is no way, based upon the history of the United States, that the gaps between these races will ever narrow. That's just not correct. It assumes that there is a system in place that prevents this. Asian Americans in this country are outperforming whites academically. The Asian Americans that are doing this as a cohort have fewer resources, less family wealth lower income levels than whites. This is not a problem that is intractable.
Well, the cliche goes, they have tiger moms who make them do their homework and take this stuff seriously, and the culture in their families is better suited to, you know, making sure the kids do their work than some of these other groups, and that's why they overperform.
Well, coming from a Jewish background myself, I had a tiger Jewish mom that didn't let me go out, after school and hang out at the basketball court with my buddies and drive around and see girls. We had to study and we had to achieve. The most important educational institution in the United States, and I think perhaps in the UK as well, is the family. Learning begins at the cradle. It doesn't begin at first grade. It doesn't end at 12th grade. It begins at the cradle. And moms and dads within the Asian community expect certain academic achievements. And that can be replicated among whites, Hispanics, and Asian and African Americans as well.
So in a sense, your argument is it's defeatist to have quotas and this kind of affirmative action, because actually as a society what we should be saying is helping and encouraging and maybe even forcing some of these communities to improve what they're doing within their own families, to early life education, helping through, you know, resourcing and other means, instead of putting the onus at the end of the process on institutions to kind of fix a problem that society allowed to happen earlier in their lives. Is that sort of part of the argument?
Well, that's an incredibly important part of the argument and the dialogue about closing the educational gaps between the races, but there is something else that is deeply troubling about using race, and that is colleges and universities that lower the bar for African Americans and Hispanics often see that those students who are admitted either drop out because their academic backgrounds are not sufficient to compete at some of these colleges or universities, or whereas they hope to become doctors or engineers or major in computer science, they find that those majors and areas of study are just too competitive for them. And while they may not drop out of schools like Duke and Stanford, they switch from computer science and pre-med into the humanities or the social sciences, where had they gone to a school where their qualifications were better matched, then they would graduate with degrees in engineering and biology and perhaps go on to medical school. That's another important element that I think will change when these opinions come down.
So there's a practical argument there that sort of pushing and pulling the outcomes doesn't actually help the students. In other words, that they would reach a better place later in life if they weren't artificially pushed into places that maybe didn't suit them.
That's exactly right. And there's data and studies to endorse that view. Plus there's one other element here. Often, and we've heard it and we can read it and we've seen it a million times, minority kids on competitive campuses will say that their friends and colleagues believe and have expressed to them that the only reason that they are there is because they are a certain race, not because they were academically qualified. So those kids who truly were academically qualified feel like, you know, because the bar is lowered for all African Americans, even though I scored as well as any Asian on this campus, people think I'm here because I'm black.
So it actually takes away from their achievement. Now, I'm not going to try and do a gotcha here, Mr. Bloom, but I do feel like the last couple of arguments would equally apply to affirmative action based on economic criteria. So if you're in favor of affirmative action for people who have had a more deprived background or have had a less good education, they too would arrive at the college without the necessary preparation. They might also suffer. They might have to change course. They might have to drop out. How is that any different?
Well, that is very true. Well, you may notice that I said lower the bar a little bit. You cannot lower the bar dramatically for kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, just as you cannot lower the bar for kids from ethnic or racial backgrounds. So that may be an outcome. But more importantly, kids who come from disadvantaged backgrounds don't walk around campus with signs saying family below poverty level, or I'm the first in my family to go to college. You won't know that just looking at kids from those backgrounds. They may disclose it to their friends and others, but you won't know it.
So there's less stigma. Is it not similarly defeatist, though? If you're saying the most important unit is the family and schools and early life education, to say we're going to put our finger on the scales to help people who've had less advantageous family lives, less advantageous education, is just the same. It's giving up on the root cause of the problem, and it's putting the onus on these institutions. What's actually, as a society, we need to fix that so that those provide better ladders out of underperforming schools, do better in terms of helping families look after their kids, and generally not give up on them.
Well, I don't see it as an either-or proposition, Freddie. Yes, families, mothers and fathers are going to have to change their behavior. They're going to have to demand more of their children. They're going to have to spend more time and emphasize the importance of family life and early education from the cradle through the very first grade. But that doesn't mean that colleges and universities can't recognize that there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of really academically gifted kids that have, for a variety of reasons, grown up in households that just don't have the resources for tutors who attend schools in neighborhoods where those schools aren't as fulsome with their academic offerings as private schools in this country or suburban well-to-do schools in this country. So lowering the bar a little bit for those kids, rural areas, things like that, that's not really in great tension with what I'm talking about with the family.
But would a better solution not be saying, let's provide funds to people for private tutoring, let's put schools for gifted kids in the middle of these deprived neighborhoods, let's try and build ladders out of those situations? I mean, as a liberal, a classical liberal or a philosophical liberal, would you not prefer to be making that argument, that a true meritocracy, where universities just pick the best people, the people who they think are going to flourish the most, and it's the job of national governments and wider society to make sure that that opportunity is well spread?
Again, I don't think it's an either or. I think our societies, our culture needs to be addressed to some degree by government intervention. When you measure what government has done in the past, however, tens of billions, I withdraw that, trillions of dollars in this country have been spent trying to narrow the gaps in educational attainment between African Americans and Hispanics on the one hand and whites and Asians on the other. It has been, I would think, just really modestly successful. We can spend more money, but I think the bulk of the solution is at the cradle and at the family. And could resources be put there? Sure, but it's really going to be up to moms and dads to do this. And I have seen this over the last 8 years. We have dozens of Asian students who have participated in these lawsuits. I have been to their homes. I have been to one-bedroom, very modest apartments in Queens, New York, where mom is a maid at a midtown hotel. Dad is a doorman at an apartment building on the Upper East Side. Two children kind of live in the living room while mom and dad have the bedroom. Very modest backgrounds. How is it that these kids have done so well in school, so well in their standardized tests? It's because mom and dad were there and encouraged them. They put resources, limited resources, into their education. So that's what needs to be done more than just about anything else.
So there needs to be some uncomfortable home truths spoken to some of these other communities that are underperforming, saying, look, you need to focus on family life. We need to focus on making sure that, you know, mom and dad are paying proper attention to education. And, you know, I guess some of these communities need to take responsibility for the outcomes.
Well, that's right. Now, keep in mind that Students for Fair Admissions is a bit of a one-trick pony. We believe that race and ethnicity should not be an element in college admissions. We did not go to the Supreme Court and tell the Supreme Court how to craft family policy, how to encourage moms and dads to get their kids studying longer and spending more resources on tutors and things like that. So we have a narrow focus, but there are dozens of think tanks, social service organizations that are in the business of doing what we just talked about.
Let's end on a bit of a practical note. If you're successful, if the principle is changed so that race cannot be included in admissions, obviously top colleges and universities would have to change their admissions process. Do you think there would be further ramifications? Do you think it would be a kind of tidal effect that suddenly corporate boards, other institutions could no longer consider race as well? Or do you think it would stop at the universities?
No, here's my great hope. My great hope is that the opinion that comes out of these two cases provides this country with a legal doctrine, a doctrine that can be applied to the area of employment, can be applied to fellowships and scholarships, can be applied to voting issues and contracting issues, that doctrine will be the beginning of the restoration of the great colorblind covenant that has held together this country through very difficult historical episodes. So that's my hope, is that the justices give us something that not only applies to just higher education, but also these other very important areas of American life.
And when do you think that might happen? What should we be looking out for?
Probably the last week of June 2023. We don't know what date. It could come earlier. These are my seventh and eighth cases that I've worked on. You just never know. But I think common wisdom is that the more difficult cases are put off to the very end, and that's when I expect them to come.
Fascinating. Well, we will be tuning in for sure. Thank you so much, Edward Bloom, for telling us about your campaign.
Thanks for having me, Freddie. I enjoyed this.
That was Edward Bloom, the conservative legal strategist who has devoted a huge amount of energy, time, and money over the years fighting against affirmative action on grounds of race. Probably some of you would think from the left that he is just rolling back decades of progress, that he's going to return us to some kind of white supremacist world. Some, maybe from the right or from a more libertarian perspective, might think that he doesn't go far enough and that by allowing any kind of affirmative action, he's only taking half measures. Well, whatever you think, let us know in the comments. It's always good to hear from you. In the meantime, thanks for tuning in. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.